Good afternoon, and welcome to the inaugural program of the Experts Forum, FTI Consulting Compass Lexicon, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org. I am Dr. Craig Lewis, Madison S. Wigington Professor of Finance at Vanderbilt University's Owen Graduate School of Management and moderator for today's program. The Expert Forum series is made possible through a partnership between FTI Consulting, Compass Lexicon, and the SEC Historical Society. FTI Consulting is a global business advisory firm dedicated to helping organizations protect and enhance enterprise value in an increasingly complex legal, regulatory, and economic environment. With more than 4,200 employees located in 26 countries, FTI Consulting professionals work closely with clients to anticipate, illuminate, and overcome complex business challenges in areas such as investigations, litigation, mergers and acquisitions, regulatory issues, reputation management, strategic communications, and restructuring. Compass Lexicon is internationally recognized as a leading economic consulting firm with preeminent competition, finance, intellectual property, international arbitration, and energy practices. With more than 400 professionals in 18 offices around the world, Compass Lexicon offers a global perspective on economic matters. Compass Lexicon is a wholly owned subsidiary of FTI Consulting. Through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, the SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation. The virtual museum and archive is the premier trusted and permanent online repository of the history of the regulation of the capital markets and will welcome over 1.5 million visitors this year. The Society and the museum are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no public funding. The museum is built and exhibited independent of any SEC oversight. The Society is grateful to the generous support of FTI Consulting and Compass Lexicon in making today's broadcast possible. This afternoon's program will be the first in a series discussing cutting-edge issues at the intersection of finance, economics, and regulation. Our topic today is Dodd-Frank, derivatives, and structured finance. Joining with me are Dr. Christopher Culp, Senior Advisor at Compass Lexicon. Chris is an expert on structured finance, derivatives, structured insurance, credit risk and credit markets, and risk management. Jason Kravitz is a partner with Mayer Brown LLP. Jason was the founder of his firm's securitization practice and serves as the practice's senior partner. Dr. James Overdahl, partner with the Delta Strategy Group. Prior to joining Delta Strategy Group last year, Jim was a vice president with NERA Economic Consulting. He has previously served as chief economist for both the SEC and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Welcome. Let us begin with a brief stage-setting discussion. Jim is a former chief economist at both the SEC and the CFTC. You have a unique perspective on the events that precipitated the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008 that led to the passage of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Could you describe the key market failures that Dodd-Frank addresses?
Sure, Craig. The Dodd-Frank Act was the response of the U.S. Congress to the financial crisis of 2008. Crisis that included the collapse of Lehman Brothers, AIG, and the near collapse of several other systemically important financial institutions. Congress was acting to address what they felt were the key causes of the financial crisis. First, they sought greater transparency across financial markets, transparency to both regulators and to end users of the market. Many of these transparency reforms were aimed at the market for over-the-counter derivatives. For example, Congress required regulators to implement real-time reporting of over-the-counter derivatives transactions to swap data. In addition to this transparency objective, Congress directed that central counterparty clearing be required for most over-the-counter derivatives transactions. Congress felt that central counterparty clearing would address counterparty credit risks that were a feature of the financial crisis, particularly with AIG when it was unable to perform on certain credit default swap contracts. And there were, of course, the concerns about the spillover effects to other systemically important firms that were had related exposures. Congress also was addressing issues related to structured finance in the so-called originate-to-distribute model of banking, particularly as it was applied to some subprime home loans, where the cash flows of home loans were packaged into marketable securities with different risk-return characteristics. Congress directed regulators to require that banks have a risk retention requirement, sometimes called the skin in the game requirement, with respect to securitizations, and also attempted to make credit rating agencies more accountable for the ratings that they gave to various tranches associated with these securitizations. In addition to addressing market transparency, clearing, and subprime mortgage securitizations, the legislative process that created Dodd-Frank has been likened to a barroom brawl where the participants refrain from hitting the guy who started the fight in favor of hitting the guy they've been looking for an opportunity to hit. With Dodd-Frank, the legislation failed to address many key issues that were widely viewed as central causes to the financial crisis, such as the unraveling of systemically important government-sponsored enterprises such as Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. However, like the aforementioned brawl, Dodd-Frank addressed many issues that were not central or even remotely related to the crisis, but had more to do with settling longstanding grievances. The legislative process to the response to the financial crisis has produced financial markets reforms that have not been seen since the Great Depression. However, unlike the New Deal reforms that were aimed primarily at bank runs on retail deposits, the financial crisis of 2007-2008 has produced reforms aimed at institutional bank runs on repurchase agreements, the so-called repo market, prime brokerage, collateral, and prime money market mutual funds. Current reforms are also aimed at bolstering the resiliency of banks and other systemically important financial institutions through regulation of bank capital, bank risk profiles, and the scope of bank activities. And current reforms also address the issue of financial institutions that are judged too big to fail or too interconnected to fail. Additional reforms seek to reduce the effects of failed systemically important institutions by authorizing greater resolution powers to government authorities, and considerable controversy exists over whether these reforms will be effective in preventing another financial crisis or whether they will have the undesirable consequence of planting the seeds for the next financial crisis by merely shifting risk from one set of financially or systemically important financial institutions to other vulnerable parts of the economy. And so those are the main features and the main parts of the response of Congress. Of course, that was enacted into law, and now what we're seeing is this being implemented. We've gone past the four-year anniversary since the law's passage, but implementation through regulatory agencies across the federal government.
Thank you, Jim, for those insightful comments. If I could, I'd like to distill two of the central themes that emerge from your remarks because they're going to be what we focus on next. As we just heard, innovations in the market for over-the-counter derivative securities resulted in two key market failures. The first was the facilitation of the originate-to-distribute banking model that allowed too-big-to-fail banks to create asset-backed securitizations that were sold to investors that ultimately relied on credit rating agency assessment of risk rather than performing their own due diligence. The second market failure we will address this afternoon stems from the interconnected nature of the market for credit default swaps and the systemically important exposures financial institutions had to one another. The bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers made it clear that the inherent opacity of the pre-crisis OTC derivative market prevented financial institutions from fully understanding the systemic nature of their exposures to other financial institutions, which ultimately led to the failure and subsequent government bailout of AIG. Jason, could you discuss the regulatory responses to the market failures surrounding the asset-backed securitization market?
Okay, I'd be happy to. First of all, we've been putting emphasis on the originate-to-distribute model, but I'd like to take a step back from that. The problem they were trying to solve was the creation of poor-quality asset-backed securities, and very quickly, regulators, the legislature, a big part of the market assumed that the predominant cause for that was the originate-to-distribute model, meaning that originators originated assets to distribute them through securitization, didn't keep a piece of them, and therefore didn't bother to vet their credit quality in a way they would have had they had the so-called skin in the game that's been mentioned. To my knowledge, there is no definitive academic proof that it was the cause and effect of the poor underwriting. But Congress quickly came up in Dodd-Frank with a requirement that six different agencies together adopt a risk retention model. And by the way, when they originally proposed the rule, they got over 10,000 comments. I don't think if we proposed an amendment to the United States Constitution, we get more comments than that. The interesting thing is in the model they came up with, the very asset class that people feel started the problems, subprime mortgage-backed securities, ended up in large part not having to have any required risk retention, because what the regulators decided was that if the underlying mortgages were written in accordance with what the CFPB calls qualifying mortgage and what in retention is called qualifying residential mortgage, they don't need to have any retention, and that's expected to be the majority of the market. Similarly, if it's a GSE-guaranteed RMBS, so long as they're in receivership, which appears to be eternal at the moment, they also don't have to have risk retention. So going back to the barroom brawl analogy, you know, in that barroom brawl, the people who threw the original punches are not required to take risk retention. On the other hand, an asset like asset-backed commercial paper, multi-seller vehicles, on which no one has lost a penny in the history of that vehicle, depending on how you look at it, could be required to have 100% risk retention instead of the normal 5% risk retention. They also did not write a rule that was consistent with the European equivalent. The next thing that Congress did was, regulatory thing I'd like to focus on is the amendment of the disclosure requirements for securitizations that the SEC adopted. And I'd like to tell you, I think the SEC did a great job on this. It's a very difficult task, and the compromises they came up with, I think, were well thought out, if not universally loved. First, they had to get rid of ratings as a requirement. So they tried to focus on quality in other ways. They have a CEO certification we can talk about in more detail later. They also tried to solve the problem of very poor enforcement mechanisms for breach of warranty or servicing, and they have a new enforcement mechanism for shelves. They tried to improve bondholder communication with new bondholder communication provisions. And finally, the disclosure that everybody complained about, they've tried to correct by requiring asset-specific disclosure, asset by asset, in certain asset classes, and they'll probably expand those in the future. The FDIC came out with its own risk retention rule years ahead of the market because they wanted to prove that they were, the vanguard of regulatory reform. They also came out with Volcker. Now, we're really going back to the bar room where nobody caused the fight and got punched because, to my knowledge, nobody alleges that proprietary trading the type of securities that Volcker deals with was a cause of the Great Recession, as it would be called. But I was at the luncheon of the Economics Club when Volcker announced that he thought that that restriction should come back, which in my opinion is also a closet repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. And securitizations had to deal with that because the definition of hedge fund and private equity fund, which is what the rule purports to deal with, uses exemptions from the 1940 Act, which catch up a lot of securitization. So we can talk about that later if we have time. Then they also required redoing risk-based capital. Now, you can easily see that banks didn't have enough capital and that securitization probably should have had more capital. But the problem that no one's been able to solve so far is how to figure out how to rationally increase that capital without killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And in my opinion, so far they haven't. And securitization now, instead of being a capital arbitrage, actually is at a disadvantage to more traditional types of financing like lending, et cetera. And I think I'll stop there.
Great.
Thank you, Jason. I'd now like to turn our attention to the OTC market for credit derivatives and the regulation contained in Title VII of Dodd-Frank. Chris, could you explain what is happening in this area?
Sure. And I think I like and I appreciate Jim's original barroom brawl analogy, because Title VII of Dodd-Frank, which deals with over-the-counter derivatives, contains a very large amount of punches being thrown that have been based on, in some cases, several decades of jurisdictional and regulatory question marks that aren't quite as related to the causes of the financial crisis as it first might seem. Excuse me. The underlying logic of Title VII is that exchange-traded derivatives markets, namely futures markets, have a history of having worked very well when it comes to containing the implications of failures and to preventing the systemic spread of companies that experience financial problems and/or default. The so-called futures model, which involves calculation of initial margin requirements, money that has to be posted before a trade is made, variation margin, marking to market, central counterparties that oversee their clearing members and that have capital requirements and a variety of other requirements. This whole model has worked quite well for a long time. It was developed in the late 1800s in the United States and has withstood the test of time and a lot of major financial disruptions. So part of Dodd-Frank, the logic seems to have been that if we can simply push as much as possible — that's my interpretation, if you will, of what happened — if we can simply push as much as possible into the world that we know and trust of exchange-traded derivatives, then we'll solve and address these problems that we saw during the crisis associated with lack of transparency and excessive opacity and potential concerns about systemic risk. We can discuss later whether or not that is actually true. But the resulting Title VII, just to summarize, is actually an effort in the United States that's going on in most of the big 20 industrialized countries around the world. In September 2009, the heads of state of the G20 nations got together and basically said, we want three things to happen. We want to establish central counterparty clearing for previously non-cleared over-the-counter derivatives. We want to establish mandated execution venue format requirements, i.e., transactions that are subject to mandatory clearing should be executed on a transparent trading facility, and we want to establish mandated reporting requirements. Not very long thereafter, the BIS and IOSCO got together and said, let's add to that that non-cleared over-the-counter derivatives that remain outside of these things should be subject to higher margin requirements, and that capital required to support non-cleared swap transactions also needs to be greater than it was before. So you have those sort of five basic principles, and each country is implementing them in a different way. The United States was essentially the first mover through Dodd-Frank. We can come back and talk about the problems this has created later, but Europe in particular is rather far behind. And although some of the principles underlying the various regulations for swaps, non-cleared swaps and cleared swaps, are similar in spirit, the devil is in the details, and there are a lot of cross-border issues that continue to plague the implementation of this area. But just for a moment, in the United States, one thing we have, for example, is we have new registration requirements that classify derivatives participants — in this case, I say derivatives, meaning over-the-counter derivatives — into essentially three categories. The official two categories are swap dealer and major swap participant. Swap dealers and end users are historical terms of art that have previously been kind of like, I'll know it when I see it, without a precise definition. The OCC examination guidance had kind of a definition for a while, but an official bright line distinction was never there. Under the implementing regulations pursuant to Dodd-Frank, we now have size-based definitions of swap dealers, which are essentially on both sides of the market, acting as market makers or classic intermediaries. Second category of major swap participant is essentially an institution whose activities are big and diverse, but isn't necessarily on both sides of the market on a regular basis. And then there's the unofficial third category of an end user. which we kind of think of as a customer, to use futures market terminology. That would be the airline that uses jet fuel derivatives to manage its price risk, the agricultural cooperative that uses wheat and corn derivatives to manage its price and quantity risk, and so forth. These requirements that are aimed at non-cleared swaps and cleared swaps, as I said, fall into areas that Jim also mentioned. The first one is the mandated clearing requirement, and that essentially requires that most standardized OTC derivatives be cleared by a central counterparty now. I have to sort of pause to comment again on the barroom analogy here. The practical implementation of that thus far has had the impact of moving plain vanilla interest rate derivatives like interest rate swaps, basis swaps, overnight index swaps, and forward rate agreements, as well as certain credit default swaps on single name entities and certain corporate index products into central counterparties. That's not new. What we call OTC cleared derivatives were going on since the late 90s. And so market participants were already moving toward the model, which is somewhere between bilateral derivatives and exchange-traded derivatives, of negotiating them bilaterally and then booking them into a CCP. So what this rule does is it essentially mandates it. Rather than letting the market decide which products want to move in that direction, this sort of does it for everyone. The products that are involved, especially the interest rate derivatives, are not the products that caused the crisis. To use the language Jason used, I am aware of essentially no credible study that blames plain vanilla fixed for floating interest rate swaps for the global financial meltdown. Yet a lot of those products are exactly the ones that have been implicated by the mandatory clearing rule. Related to that is a mandatory venue execution rule for products that are subject to the clearing mandate or for other products that are specifically identified by the CFTC or SEC. They now can't be traded bilaterally. They have to be traded on what's called a swap execution facility. Without doing inadequate justice to a complicated term and a complicated debate, you can view a CEF as essentially an exchange light. It's a trading forum that isn't a full exchange. It doesn't pretend to be a full exchange, but it offers an organized forum for the electronic execution of transactions that are then booked into a central counterparty. And also that applies to these standardized products, the highly liquid products. Thus far, it's focused on credit default swaps of a single name nature and the interest rate product group. To underscore, the problems that AIG had with credit default swaps, for example, were not in single name CDSs. They were in credit default swaps based on asset-backed securities such as collateralized debt obligations. And so under the rules, as they've been articulated, ABS CDOs would not actually be subject to the mandatory clearing requirement because they are too complicated and are essentially unclearable. And so, you know, these new rules would actually not have covered some of the transactions that people pointed at to rationalize the rules. The third category, quickly moving along, is the reporting requirement. This is comprehensive. And although there's some disparity across countries in how they're implementing clearing and mandated execution, most countries have just gone all out on reporting and said you need to have at least some kind of organized reporting to a swap data repository or a trade repository, as it's called in Europe, for pretty much all OTC derivatives. Most of those rules are in effect, and they range from, as Jim mentioned, real-time reporting requirements to, in some cases, backdated loading of transactions that date to the adoption of Dodd-Frank. And in the European Union, you have to backload transactions that date back to the European Market Infrastructure Regulation implementation date. Margin and capital are also out there. But I'm going to say that they're out there and stop there because they are still in the pipeline. And although not everything's done in the clearing, execution, and reporting areas, I think we've got at least enough under our belts to get the discussion rolling forward. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Well, it's clear that there's been a lot accomplished, but there's a significant amount of unfinished business at hand. At this point in the program, I think the panel would like to change gears and move to a more open-ended discussion. I have a number of questions that I think will shed additional light on some of the topics we've already discussed. So, Jim, since you kicked things off, let me return to you. What have been some of the unintended consequences of the Dodd-Frank Act and subsequent rulemakings?
Well, I think you can point to several. One that stands out and is with respect to swap data repositories. Part of the Dodd-Frank Act required that regulators, in this case the CFTC, implement a swap data repository rule, or called the real-time reporting requirement. What we found is that for some end users, they have had their information put into the public domain, and it doesn't, maybe not directly from them as the end user, but to the counterparty to their swap, where it can be understood by the market of who's playing, particularly in some illiquid markets. What this means is for the end user is that they face higher costs to get their swaps done. The counterparty is going to require a higher spread because it's going to be more costly for them to hedge in a market where people know that they're coming to the market with size, particularly in illiquid markets. And this actually today is a good day to be discussing this because the CFTC granted regulatory relief just this morning to Southwest Airlines, which was one commercial hedger hedging their jet fuel program, or had a jet fuel hedging program, where their swap transactions they felt was costing them, I think in their congressional testimony, they said up to $60 million a year in extra hedging costs just because of the reporting requirement. And clearly the law was not aimed at commercial users of futures products or derivatives. They're the people who are using these markets to prudently manage their risk. And so that would be one example I can point to of where a law that was designed to help protect end users may have actually caused them harm.
Okay, great. So, you know, if I could leverage off that, and I'll flip it over to you in a minute, Chris, but one of the things I thought was interesting in Chris's remarks is something that I fundamentally agree with, and that is Title VII is essentially creating an exchange-light environment for clearing and sort of transacting in the over-the-counter derivatives market. One of the things that I struggled with when I was chief economist and putting the economic analysis together on some of these rules was some of the different requirements that exist in Title VII, most notably the transparency requirement and the real-time reporting obligation that exists for U.S. entities vis-a-vis their foreign counterparts, say, in the U.K. And one of the issues I felt that was salient was asking the question, if there are differential transparency regimes, what will happen to transaction activity and what's the likely consequence of that? That seems an unintended consequence of Dodd-Frank would be if significant transaction volume migrated from the U.S. to Europe. Mm-hmm. Chris, yeah?
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And Jim, at a lot of different levels, one of the broad areas of unintended consequences that we're just starting to see emerge is in the area of liquidity. And I'm not talking about there are multiple uses of that term that Dodd-Frank can affect. I'm not talking about collateral and margin. I'm talking about market liquidity, because the belief was if we do it like exchanges, which have been natural arenas for price discovery from time immemorial, then sort of we push everything into a transparent world. If we build it, they will come. In this case, it's if we put it there, liquidity will come. Well, that's only true if liquidity doesn't get fragmented in the process. And by, you know, also there's it's important to keep in mind that especially in the interest rate derivatives area, the interdealer broker market was highly transparent and highly liquid before the Dodd-Frank rules went into place. If you look at some of the studies that ISDA did on transparency in the interest rate derivatives area, not as much in some of the other products, but there weren't really a lot of complaints from end users or other categories about a lack of transparency. However, as you say, by pushing stuff into these regulatory-defined structures, you're redefining the liquidity pool based on differing institutional and regulatory definitions. One of the problems is that a CEF in the United States is not the same thing as an MTF, or a multilateral transaction facility, under MiFID II in Europe. Europe is also behind us, and so there have been a ton of cross-border issues associated with, if you have a transaction that involves one, what we call U.S. person, essentially a U.S. market participant, but one non-U.S. person, then to date you've essentially been subject to the U.S. rules, which means that we've seen a pattern where activity in U.S. dollar-denominated derivatives has tended to concentrate in CEF exchanges by U.S. entities. And this is sort of, you know, working itself out. And as Europe implements some of these rules, it could either become better or worse, because Europe is sufficiently not far along that, you know, we have this concept of substituted compliance, which is that in principle in Europe, they should say, ESMA and the other European regulators should say, well, as long as you're compliant with the equivalent of what our regulations are in the U.S., then you can play here. But that hasn't been the attitude that everybody has adopted at the different agencies. And so I think, Craig, you're right. We are seeing this sort of fragmentation occurring along certain institutional dimensions. It was clearly not intended. I mean, nobody sat down and said, I'm going to increase my size of the pie by designing this particular part of the rule. I mean, I'm from the University of Chicago. We think that does occasionally happen with regulations. But this does appear to have been something that people didn't expect when this was adopted.
I agree. Okay. Jason, I have a question for you about risk retention. While it's understandable that purely on credit protection for investor grounds, GSE, guaranteed mortgage loans, will require no retention, what about stepping back and looking at the idea behind risk retention as a whole? Does the architecture of the rule fit its purpose? And then could you discuss the lack of investor down payment requirement?
Sure. Thanks very much. Well, again, remember the purpose of the risk retention rule was essentially to bring back quality into the risk into the securitization market. So the question is, does it do that where it's necessary, and does it not do it where it's not necessary? Clearly, it does it where it's not necessary. Take autos. I jokingly refer to autos as the cockroaches of securitization, as they continued to function perfectly during the meltdown. Their volumes held up. They are fabulous investment from a credit risk point of view. There is no need to require risk retention in autos. The standard structure for autos is for the seller to keep a retained subordinated interest. On the other hand, looks like we're going to have 100% contingent, 100% retention in the ABCP market because the safe harbor that they came up with is not practical. Fortunately, there's probably a way around that if a bank buys a vertical interest in all the CP that the conduit issues. But what do we need to have a bank finance 5% of the ABCP that a conduit issues when no one's ever lost a penny? I mean, literally a penny in that market. On the other hand, we have the QRM exemption, which will be the lion's share of the market, whether it's the GSE market or the non-GSE market, where there's no risk retention and where we had all the problems before. I'd like to discuss the down payment because that I find fascinating. First of all, everybody treats the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage as really God's gift to humanity and American civilization in particular. But you have to realize, first of all, there was no 30-year fixed-rate mortgage until the 1950s. It also has turned out to be a simply horrendous way for households to build up wealth. The 30-year mortgage takes so long for somebody to develop equity in their house, and it so leverages you. You know, at more consistent rates, you end up paying three times the amount that the house cost, that I don't think it's a product that it's worth distorting the system to preserve. I think either a 15-year mortgage, which is designed for the consumer to build up equity very quickly, or a mortgage that has a higher down payment and therefore gives you equity that you'll have to defend and therefore become a much better credit risk is really the answer. So let's take the GSEs. The investor doesn't need retention there because they've got the federal government standing behind it, but the GSEs need protection there. Just recently, Director Watt said he was intending to loosen guidelines on down payments and other things for GSE mortgages. A lot of people think we're sliding down the slippery slope again of poor underwriting. So I think there's a lot of irony, if we want to be generous in the way we described it, in the rule. And I think that there's a lot to be, you know, to criticize the way it was ended up being adopted. Let me just say, I'm not intending to criticize any particular regulator. I think it's a very, very hard mandate to meet. But from my point of view, from, you know, being a market participant, that's the way I look at it. I will also say one other thing. I think the United States is still too arrogant regulatorily with regard to the rest of the world. There is no way under the risk retention rule for a foreign issuer to comply with the rule by arguing that its country's own risk retention rule is a, you know, is a substantial equivalent to the U.S. rule so that they can just comply with their risk retention rule. Now, maybe they can go the no-action route to do that, but I do think that if the United States wishes to continue to have the best and most attractive, deepest and most liquid capital markets in the world, we ought to start recognizing that some other very sophisticated markets do things differently and just acknowledge that that's the case. And then the investor can decide whether it's adequate for himself or not.
Great. So I'm going to follow up, if I could, on some of those remarks, because during your earlier remarks, you had indicated that you thought that Reg AB2 came out as a pretty decent rule for the SEC. And the basic idea underlying Reg AB2 was to effectively solve, in an economic term, an adverse selection problem, where investors were being asked to value a security, in this case a securitization, but they didn't actually understand the assets that comprised the loan pool that they were trying to value. So Reg AB2 was a rule that really its intent was to create transparency so that investors could do a better job of pricing these securities in the first place. And we felt that this was important. And to give you an idea, just some of the issues around this, when we were going through the risk retention and Reg AB2 process, the economists at the SEC did a study where they actually tried to evaluate mortgage, sort of the rates of serious delinquency in mortgages as a way of considering whether the qualified mortgage standard was appropriate or whether QRM should be set equal to QM, which is where the rule came out. And what we found was that in the private label market, our study indicated that those loans that were created during the crisis or those pools, actually the underlying assets, the underlying mortgages experienced default rates of about 34%, right? And if you were to look at the GSE loans, they were maybe on the order of about 10%. But it was our thinking that if the loan standards were that lax, that you could end up with failure rates in the order of about one out of every three loans going belly up in a pool, that maybe investors should be forced to look at the actual data or have the opportunity to look at the actual data. So let me actually end that discussion with a question.
Where is the question?
Yeah, there wasn't one. And that is, what do you expect to be the combined effect of requiring some assets to have asset-level disclosure and not others? What do you think about the CFPB's opinion on privacy, and how does that extend to public markets but not private deals? Just some of the general features of AB2.
Well, I think that it's a very interesting question. Where is the dynamics of Reg AB2 going to drive offerings? You know, how's it going to change the marketplace? First of all, the big fear that the public, what used to be the public market is going to be driven into 144A will not occur, in my opinion. And if for no other reason, then a huge part of the public market is frequent large issuers. So there's no way that the 144A market can absorb that sort of volume. Securitization is too important to frequent large issuers. So I don't think one thing the SEC was afraid of, which is we're going to drive everything into the 144A market and therefore we're going to have to regulate that down the road, is going to come to pass. Now, the privacy issue is a very serious one, because what the CFPB did was write an opinion that applied only to disclosure under the 33 Act on Edgar. So if as we expect to be the case, the public disclosure requirements tend to bleed into the 144A market. They can't the asset-specific disclosures, which you think so highly of, and I understand why, can't bleed into the private market until the privacy issue is resolved, because the CFPB opinion is useless, literally, with regard to the private market. It, by the way, doesn't cover Graham Leach Bliley for the public market. And so there's still a lot of work to do on how we're going to solve our privacy issues, and maybe it's going to take Congress, as a matter of fact, to do that. And I'd like to point out that, you know, with the change in political parties controlling Congress, you know, the opportunity for that might be a little better than if that hadn't happened. Now, with regard to asset-level disclosure, I don't even think we're done. We cover certain assets now, like autos, auto leases, CMBS, RMBS, but we don't cover other important asset classes. And Dodd-Frank literally requires it for everything, you know, roughly everything. So I expect the SEC to add asset classes as we go along. I think the things that will come into the issues that will go into the 144A market are as follows. I think foreign issuers are going to be frightened of the CEO certification. You know, the reputation Americans have for putting you in jail for a capital markets crime is really quite outsized throughout the world. So I think the Sarbanes-Oxley analog in the CEO certification is going to scare some foreign issuers into the 144A market. And by the way, it doesn't have to be the CEO of your company. It's the CEO of the depositor. So it'll be the guy who's in charge of securitization, not the CEOs of the big issuers themselves. I think also since the certification requires the one that everybody is most concerned about is it said there's a reasonable basis to believe that the cash flows will match what's provided for in the contract. That's the one that everybody's most afraid of. So you may see a bifurcation where your senior tranches are publicly registered and your subordinated tranches go into the 144A market. And until you get the privacy issue solved, I don't think you'll get asset-level disclosure to go into the private market. And I think that maybe is the biggest issue to come out of the new Reg AB2.
Can I just add one quick thing? I mean, Jason, you may have more informed thoughts than I do, but I was giving a talk on this subject in Zurich a couple of months ago, and one of the issues in Europe has been a big question mark over why the once vibrant and, frankly, the staggeringly rapidly growing market for securitization based on loans to small and medium business enterprises has experienced such significant contraction recently. And the European Central Bank has tried to advance some sort of specific rules in this area that are designed to get AB2-like disclosures and transparency for some of the underlying European ABS. But the questions that I heard in that forum and from what I've been hearing elsewhere is the operational problems are just huge. Actually getting compliance, and this may be more of a unique problem in Europe than it is here because you have so many different underlying jurisdictions, but it seems like very little use is being made of what information is being reported on the underlying asset classes and that the information itself is pretty bad from what I've heard. Is that right? I mean,
yeah. Let me say this about that. To quote President Kennedy, he always used to start out that way. The Europeans have had what I call an Alec Guinness moment. If you remember the bridge over the River Kwai, after the British took over building the railroad from the Japanese, and the British sent a commando unit led by Jack Hawkins and William Holden in to blow up the bridge. Alec Guinness was so proud of the job his troops had done that he discovered the sabotage and tried to stop the sabotage from occurring. And then all of a sudden he goes, my God, what have I done? And he falls on the lever and he blows up the bridge. Okay, that's what I call an Alec Guinness moment when you realize to your own horror that you've been a total, you know, jerk and you've caused the problems you weren't supposed to cause, you're supposed to be fixing. Well, the Europeans have really screwed up securitization through their regulations. Their economies look anemic compared to even, you know, the United States economy. And so they're trying to figure out how to bring it back now. So one of the things they're doing is to try to fix all the excessive regulations that they've imposed on securitization in Europe, which is doubly ironic because they didn't create the bad assets from the Great Recession. The Americans did, and all of our markets have come back except for private label RMBS. I think Europeans have generally been behind Americans, and again, I'm not indicating they're, you know, backwards or we're always going to be better or we know more about technology than they do. But their businesses have always been behind on the technology of receivables. And that's one reason, I think, that securitization took longer to develop in Europe. And then you're absolutely right. I couldn't agree with you more. You atomize the market there, you know, with the 34 members of the common market. Every country has different rules. You perfect in different ways. You've acquired businesses in different countries, so, you know, that your computers don't necessarily sync with each other. It's just a much more difficult job to do.
Great. Chris, maybe I could direct the next question to you. How is the implementation of mandated clearing and execution regulations in the U.S. and Europe impacted liquidity in dollar versus non-dollar swaps?
It's a good question. And the empirical evidence continues to be evolving because, you know, a lot of these mandated clearing and mandated venue execution rules got phased in 2013. Some of them carried into 2014. So we have sort of since early 2013, we have good data that are coming out of the swap trade repositories or swap data repositories. It's interesting because you ask an academic economist, do you want more data? Usually the answer is yes, without having to stop and think too hard about it. It's worth going back to Jim's comment. This imposes tremendous costs to get all this reporting going on. But from an academic perspective, oh, gee, we've now got great data coming out of swap data repositories that we can start to study. And what we're seeing both from, you know, sort of anecdotal evidence as well as some of the data that you look at, and it, by the way, excuse me, the format of this data isn't easy to analyze in this particular context because what you get is stuff that is reported and stuff that is traded on a SEF. It doesn't necessarily mean that it had to be. Without getting too nuanced, they're made available to trade transactions that are required to be traded on SEFs do not represent all of SEF volume. There's still about 10% of any, if I recall right, about 10% on any given month of the activity is actually optional. It's the market deciding I'd like to trade here. Then you also have impediments to that through things like the fact that CFTC continues to push off, at least as recently, I think, as today, there was another deferral, maybe yesterday, another deferral of the package trade rule. Is that right, Jim? Sound right? And so basically, if you have a transaction that's subject to the clearing and execution requirements bundled together with one that isn't, which is very common with interest rate derivatives that have embedded optionality in other products, or a swaption that isn't subject to these rules combined with an interest rate swap or something like that. We still have sort of no idea how those are going to be handled from a regulatory standpoint. And all of this is resulting in a, same as Jason said, the European, not quite the Alec Guinness moment, but the Europeans have realized they've followed a lot of our lead. They haven't implemented the regulations yet, but they're also noticing some of the problems, and European institutions, not regulators, are concerned about getting subject to one of these requirements. If you do something that's got a question mark over it, do you have to be registered as a SEF? I mean, one of the big market participants in this area, I won't name them, I guess it's public information, but they have both a SEF and the European equivalent of a SEF, just to be sure, so that if a non-U.S. person decides they want to do a transaction, that they end up taking the regulatory risk. If you want to play it safe, you do it with the SEF, because you might get classified as subject to CFTC regulations, even though you're not a U.S. entity, you might be considered a U.S. person under current rules. All of this is very arcane in some ways, but it's evolving, which is why it's a good question but a hard question. The anecdotal evidence, at least for a while, indicated that there was a big shift
toward U.S. dollar-denominated transactions occurring in CEFs, simply because non-U.S. institutions were afraid of transacting with U.S. institutions in a U.S. currency without being classified or registered as a CEF, because the CFTC at one point was making it pretty clear that it was going to go after people abroad. And I think that one is a big stay tuned. And honestly, it could go either way. I mean, the liquidity could end up more fragmented, or some of this could equalize. I'm not sure. Maybe you have an opinion, or you all. But Jim, do you?
No.
Yeah. I think it's a stay tuned.
Yeah. So Jim, let me throw one your way. Since we're talking about the CFTC a little bit, how will it use its anti-disruptive trading authority, and how will the CFTC determine what disruptive trading actually is?
Well, anti-disruptive trading was part of the Dodd-Frank that amended the Commodity Exchange Act, and it was not defined. I mean, there were some examples given in the statute of what they wanted the CFTC to do. But I think part of the problem is that the CFTC has been considering this for up to 4 years now and has been unable to come up with a bright line of what constitutes disruptive or disruptive trading. And so I think what this means is that it's going to be determined by enforcement actions, and you're going to see cases brought and will decide whether they are part of that or not. I think the difficulty for the CFTC is to distinguish between trading behavior that may be in line with what Congress was intending that would be prohibited, such as somebody intentionally canceling transactions or canceling orders after they place them in order to try to influence the price, versus legitimate market making, where a market maker is canceling orders in order to update to new information in the order flow coming in. So it's going to be a difficult task for a regulator to discern just based on the data without knowing intent what this activity is. But I think because it's so hard to define a bright line, I think that you're going to see this resolved through enforcement actions, and unfortunately it's not very good news for compliance departments who have to figure this out, but I think that's the state of the world.
So this is just another example of how difficult it is to draw these bright lines, and there's a direct analogy in my mind to the Volcker Rule and the implementation of the Volcker Rule, and how are you going to distinguish between proprietary trading activity and simple market making?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the anti-disruptive trading was to try to come up with a manipulation light, something where you didn't need to go through the entire process of working up a manipulation case to deal with data that Congress felt should not be in the market. But yes, you're going to have this issue of how do you separate out nefarious activity just based on the data versus legitimate behavior, not only legitimate behavior, but behavior that you would want to encourage in the market because it helps make the markets work better for all end users.
Could I make a comment
on
that,
please?
This sort of is a comment on every question you've asked, okay? And the way I would distill it is, are we doing things the right way? You know, is the type of rules that we're adopting correct? Is the process we're using correct? Is the outcome correct? Are they good for the market? Because certainly the intention has all been good. I have no doubt about that. And I just want to give you some statistics to make everybody think about this. The Ten Commandments, which is the moral foundation of Western society, is about 200 words. The United States Constitution, what I consider to be the greatest constitution in the history of the world and has really functioned pretty well all this time, is a little over 7,000 words. The proposing release for the CFPB rule on QM, which, by the way, is whether a customer can afford to repay a mortgage, which I think should be a bank core competency, is 250,000 words. There's no rule that's been proposed recently where the proposing release is not 500 pages. I just think we've gone astray in the way that we propose, adopt, and apply rules, because the more complicated they become, instead of becoming more precise and therefore a way for you to conduct your activity, they just create more and more questions, and nobody develops a moral sense of what they're supposed to be doing. They just play to the extremely complicated rules. I literally think that we've gone astray in the way we're trying to regulate ourselves now, and it's not an excuse that the economy itself is so complicated.
So I have a tendency to agree with that perspective, and the way I think about it is that so I'm new to regulation, or I was new to regulation when I came in 3 years ago. And, you know, as an economist, I try to think of first-order effects. You know, what are the principal ideas you're trying to communicate? And it seems to me that if you were to regulate around first-order implications, you could capture 99% of what it is, whatever market failure is you're trying to correct. And one of the reasons why these rules become so long and complicated is that I believe that most of the regulators think they only have one bite at the apple. Right? And so they have to try to anticipate every possible contingency and bake that into the rule ahead of time, whereas from my perspective, I think we would be much better off if we had simple rules where it was easy to then subsequently see where the market failures actually occurred in response to, let's say, arbitraging a particular regulation.
I agree with you, and I think the pernicious part of it is it gives regulators an excuse not to regulate. All they got to do is go look at the rule. But it gives the people they regulate no training as to what's good and what's bad. It's just a set of rules that they have to comply with. You are not developing bankers who develop a sense of right and wrong. I mean, really, which you would have with principles as opposed to 2,000-page rules.
Interestingly, though, the idea of principles-based regulation can still lead you in one of two different directions. We have had a problem in derivatives regulation, as everybody here knows. I mean, since the Shad-Johnson Accord in 1986 all the way up to the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000, which ironically was blamed by some as part of being a cause of the crisis, what the CFMA of 2000 did is it moved us away from a product-based toward an institutional-based regulatory structure. Dodd-Frank brought back product regulation in force because all of these hundreds of pages are about what is a CDO, what is an ABS, what is a non-cleared swap, what is a swap. These are not institutionally founded, and that's the problem is if you're an individual or at a company and you're actually a market participant, you're doing what you're doing, but you're doing it in the framework of regulations that are aimed at products, which are constantly changing. And no matter how many pages, there's no way that you can adopt a sort of ethics and principles-based approach to a product. A product is a product. It's a piece of paper with a staple in it. It's not a thing. In any case, I suppose this is too philosophical to get into this late in the discussion, but I'm not actually even arguing against product-based regulation, although I have in some of my writings. I'm just saying that it is certainly one of the reasons for this, because when you're going to establish a regulatory framework based on what an ABS is, you got to spend a lot of time defining an ABS as a regulatory and legal matter.
Great. So, gentlemen, I think we're actually approaching the end of our broadcast. So Chris, Jason, and Jim, thank you for the excellent discussion today. It's been a pleasure being with you, with all of you. Today's broadcast will soon be available in audio MP3 format in the Virtual Museum and Archive at www.sechistorical.org. An edited transcript will be added later. Both the audio and transcript will be accessible under Programs and under the dedicated The Experts Forum site under Programs in the Virtual Museum and Archive. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I'd like to thank again FTI Consulting and Compass Lexicon for their generous commitment and assistance in making today's program possible. Thank you for joining with us today. Good afternoon.